Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome again to another edition of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. Today we revisit a story because a lot has happened since it first broke. I'm speaking of the sexual abuse that took place in the United Kingdom at the hands of Jimmy Savile, the late BBC broadcaster. He is known to being Britain's worst ever paedophile. And hundreds of cases have come forward since he died and since the case was broken by the BBC program Panorama. But in that time, it's not only the victims that have been coming forward, but also a lot of innocent people and celebrities from the 60s, 70s who are completely innocent, who were targets of Operation U-Tree. Many people have spoken out against Operation U-Tree, calling it nothing more than a witch hunt. For example, Cliff Richard, who was away on holiday, had his home broken into by police and it was covered by television cameras, despite the fact that there still has yet to be any charges brought against Sir Cliff Richard. Another one is the comedian Jimmy Tarbuck. He was subsequently bailed and rebailed until the police finally announced 14 months later that there isn't enough evidence, or rather there isn't any evidence at all. The BBC broadcaster, Paolo Gambaccini, was off the air for more than a year after police came knocking at his door at around 4:30 in the morning. Again, they discovered that the evidence that was brought against him was false. And just recently, in the last 2 weeks, the legendary BBC broadcaster, Tony Blackburn, was dismissed from the BBC because of something that happened in the early 1970s. Something of which Tony Blackburn says is totally false, and that the BBC is using him as a scapegoat. Now, we're not going to talk about that story right on today's program because it is forever changing. But Operation U-Tree, while there have been some arrests, for example, Max Clifford, the well-known UK publicist, Rolf Harris, and others, many, however, feel that this is turning into nothing more than a witch hunt. Even people who were not part of the entertainers group from that period have said that this is nothing more than a witch hunt and nothing more than the police trying to deflect the blame from their mishandling of Jimmy Savile back in the 70s. Now, back in the 70s, there was a lot of talk and even some police inquiries that were done discreetly about what Jimmy Savile was up to, but the police never brought it forward. The BBC broadcaster Paul Gambaccini wrote a book last year about his experience. He speaks next to Stephen Sacker.
I was not going to let the Metropolitan Police and Crown Prosecution Service write the last chapter in the story of my life. And I knew that if I wanted the honest story to be told, I would have to tell it. It was when I was in the cell for 4 hours waiting for a solicitor to appear, because I was arrested at 4:38 in the morning and solicitors do not work in the dark, that I made myself three promises. I was going to lose some weight, I was going to play the piano more, and I was going to write a book. If you arrest a journalist, he will keep a journal. No surprise. I learned very quickly that unless I wrote it down, I would forget it, because it was all based in falsehood, so that it wouldn't integrate with reality. So I had to write it down to remember it. And that's what I did, having no idea that this would go on for 12 months. Because I never knew my accuser and the second person whom the police brought into the case to justify my arrest, I thought surely this must end after my three-month bail period. But in fact, as you know, I was rebailed for up to 12 months.
Well, let's not race too far ahead in the case. Let's stick with that first day. I think it was November 2nd, 2013.
October 29, 2013.
Well, end of October.
November 22nd. You've got the day that I was named.
Right.
I was arrested on October 29th.
So let's go back to that day. 4:30 in the morning, you say. Yes. Found the police at your door.
Yes.
Was it a complete surprise?
It was not. Because I had been the first person in Britain who was a public person to speak out against Jimmy Savile, even before the documentary that had exposed him, and my picture had been on the front page of many newspapers next to his. When, to my astonishment, I saw that the police had opened a dedicated website and a dedicated phone line and invited members of the public to accuse celebrities, saying, "You will be believed," I thought, well, I've had it, because my picture's been next to Savile on the front pages, and in a country where, under the mutation of the justice system, from the centuries-old evidence-based system to the subjective rumor and accusation-based system, all it takes is two people to accuse you. And since I've been broadcasting for 40 years, I'm known to tens of millions of people, and it will not take more than one or two distressed individuals. And so for the period until I was arrested, I actually thought this is a real possibility. And I warned my husband, I warned my PA, I warned my lawyer. My lawyer couldn't believe it. You know, he said, oh, this will never happen. And I said, don't kid yourself. This is a witch hunt. You see, this is the second witch hunt I've lived through in my life. As a little boy in America, I lived through McCarthyism. And the parallels are many. It's just that the crime du jour changed from being suspected of being a communist to being suspected of being a pervert. But
if I may stop you just for a sec, just to think about this word witch hunt, I'm obviously that you absolutely convinced, of course, of your own innocence. You saw it from the get-go as a series of false accusations. But the police at that point had one individual who was saying that you were responsible for serious sexual abuse, crimes against him. And the police at that point had, surely, to test the evidence, to conduct an investigation.
Well, believe it or not, they did without my even knowing it. The case was investigated for 5 months. I didn't know I was being investigated. And then it was dropped for insufficient evidence. That's the phrase that is used. But then another officer came onto the case and decided to rev it up and said, okay, who can we get to corroborate this? And so number one, who I call primary, said, well, there was this guy I took horse riding lessons with in the mid-1970s, late 1970s. So they went to this guy and said, would you like to accuse Paul? Now, some viewers may go, whoa, the police go to people and ask them if they'd like to accuse people? And yes, and they phone them up as well. I was...
You're saying this was a sort of... A fishing expedition mentality that the police had, was it?
Well, yes. It had been brought to my attention 2 weeks before my arrest by the BBC radio broadcaster Liz Kershaw, who phoned me to tell me that she'd been phoned by Yewtree and asked if she would like to make an accusation against Dave Lee Travis, who was another of the suspects in Yewtree.
Yewtree, we should say, is the overarching operation name for that police investigation that followed the revelations about the entertainer Jimmy Savile.
When that's correct.
The police became convinced that there were other prominent, high-profile entertainers and others who may well have been responsible for sexual abuse crimes in the 70s and 1980s, historical sexual
abuse. Yes, yes, based on a very interesting medical misconception that sexual perversion was an airborne contagion that could be contracted from walking through the same corridors Jimmy Savile had passed through 5 minutes previous. That's not the way it works.
No, but to be fair to the police, there was some evidence that at the time, in the 70s, there was a different mindset, different values and behaviours, which may not have led to whistleblowing at the time, but which were abusive.
Yes, but there's never been an attempt by this younger generation of police, or indeed media people, to have a historical perspective. There was a unique 35-year period in the history of mankind where you could not die from a sexually transmitted disease. In the 1940s, antibiotics knocked syphilis on the head. And then in 1983, the new disease, which came to be known as AIDS, was known. In between, there was an explosion of sexual activity. Now, I wasn't taking part in it because I was too young. But what happened was, first of all, there were no fatal consequences because of antibiotics. Then, no pregnancy consequences because of the birth control.
Sure, but if the sexual behaviors, certainly those committed by prominent people, were abusive, non-consensual, then that was criminal.
Oh, of course. And, you know, I've said, there is, always has been, and always will be a way to deal with genuine offenders. It's called the law. And you don't need a witch hunt to enforce the law.
But isn't that actually what the police were pursuing in your case? When they were trying to find corroboration, they were asking other people who perhaps were around you at the time for their memories and evidence. They were conducting an investigation. I mean, you called it a witch hunt because you are so convinced and you knew what you had done and what you hadn't done, but I'm just trying to see it from the police's point of view. At the time, there was a massive public demand that they take on these prominent people.
Well, yes, because they were trying to divert the spotlight off their own failure to catch Savile in his lifetime, even though various policemen across the country knew about Savile. The misconception is the police never considered the relationship of the celebrity to his or her audience. The man in the street is known to the people he has met in his life. The celebrity is known to the people he has met in his life and millions of others, for some of whom he or she fulfills emotional needs. And therefore, when you ask millions of people to accuse someone, some of these people will have imagined memories. And I'm not saying that they are liars or chancers. It's interesting that most people say, oh, your accuser must have been after it for money. I don't say that at all. And you'll notice in the 23 months following my arrest, I've never criticized my accuser because I don't know him, I don't know his state of mind. He may have been a chancer, he may have been a fantasist. Every celebrity has a stalker or fantasist, or he may be a distressed individual. And there are distressed people. Sometimes, as the solicitor pointed out to me, someone who has been abused by someone else, but they've put your head on that person's body to make it seem a more palatable or important event. So you can't tell what motivates someone to make a false accusation. And it's very annoying that I will never know. And indeed, one of the police officers who came by to talk to me after my case was over said, you will never know his state of mind.
Tell me about the impact and the cost of this 12-month period in your life. Because the police bail kept getting renewed. The investigation nominally was continuing, although there was no sign of any charge or court appearance. So what was it like for you during that 12 months?
At the beginning, your world contracts like a reverse of the Big Bang. You go to your core. The police succeed in taking away all of the external parts of your identity. You are immediately denied employment. You are shunned by organizations whose company and loyalty you have cultivated for decades.
The BBC was your main employer. Did you feel shunned, abandoned by them?
Well, the matter of fact is that the moment I was named, I was dropped by the BBC, which I did not realize could happen because I had a year contract, and they stopped paying me. But there was a technicality. My show was an independent production, so they could say to my producer, we will not broadcast any programs with Paul. So therefore, I was not getting paid.
You felt let down.
Yes, but I could understand at first what they were doing because they'd come under heat over Savile. But as time went by and I withdrew my support for being off the air because I knew it was nothing, I do believe that the BBC upper management, not the radio management, because they stayed in touch with me and were supportive. You may find it hard to believe that from the moment I was arrested until this very moment, I have not spoken to any member of BBC management. Outside of the radio services, I have not had a phone call from anyone to say, what is this about? Or, how are you? It's this lack of interest in knowing what this is about, which I find fascinating. Obviously, they're lawyered up to the nostrils. They don't want to know anything.
You were hurt by that, I can tell. I mean,
well, of course. I had just had, 3 weeks before my arrest, seasons on both Radios 2 and Radio 4 of the domestic radio networks, celebrating my 40th anniversary on the BBC. So within a month, I go from Mr. 40 years to Mr. Who? Because they could not, in their mind, afford to be tainted by an association with me. Now, like many bad generals, they were fighting the last war. The last war was Savile. The new war was the attempt to discredit the 1970s and, through some of its aging stars, the BBC. They didn't really cotton on to that.
I hear the hurt in your voice, but I guess the bottom line of all of this is that the police investigation that you've criticized so strongly in this interview did, in the end, yield a number of convictions. A number of people who had been serially sexually abused in their past finally found a path to justice through Operation Yew Tree. And if that meant that some other people, such as yourself, were investigated, faced a cloud of suspicion, and were finally exonerated, then I suppose the police would say, and maybe the public would say, so be it, a price worth paying.
A wrong is never rectified by the commission of another wrong. And furthermore, out of the 17 Yew Tree cases that have been concluded as we speak, the millions of pounds of taxpayer money spent, the thousands of police man hours spent, how many people were sent to prison for the first time?
Two.
Two people sent to prison for the first time. Three people who had been in prison before for sexual offenses sent there again for sexual offenses. They were the lowest of low-hanging fruit. Operation Yew Tree, had it been a football club, would have been relegated. It lost such a high percentage of its matches.
But I come back to the thought about the victims. The words of Mark Williams Thomas are interesting. He was one of the journalistic investigators who blew the Saville story wide open. And he says, post-Saville, that case lifted the lid on people who had been considered untouchable because of their celebrity status. Add to that the numbers. The police say, I think they released figures earlier this year saying that more than 1,000 people had been investigated as a result of new victims who'd come forward as a result of Saville and Operation Yew Tree. That is an awful lot of people who felt that they received no justice for many years who now feel that their stories are being listened to.
But of course, why do you think I went on television and discussed Jimmy Saville before Mark Williams Thomas's documentary was even shown? I supported genuine victims, and I still do. But now there is a new, though smaller, group of persons who have been wronged. It's the falsely accused. This is not an either-or situation. We want justice for all. And everyone who has been wronged in any way, whether as a victim of sexual abuse or a victim of false accusation, knows what it is like to be wronged. And we want justice for all of us.
Did the police release your name, or I thought it was the press itself who got hold of it because they'd seen activity outside your house early one morning? Do you believe the police did it?
Oh, of course.
I mean, taking your word for it, and you're convinced that the police, therefore, leaked your name to the press, do you think that there should be legal sanction for police officers who do that sort of thing?
Well, of course I do, and it's disgraceful that post-Leveson it continues, and it has continued in almost all of the Yew Tree cases, where the press know that the suspect either is about to be arrested or is in the process of being arrested.
Let's talk about lessons to be learned.
I've got to tell you one thing here. The BBC Panorama program knew I was going to be arrested 4 days before I was.
How do you know that?
They told me. And I said, where did you get that from? And they said, Absolute Radio. I said, Absolute Radio? That's not even a journalistic radio station. It's a pop music station. So that's how the word gets around. Now, I am not accusing my officers of leaking the information. The police are a huge organization, like the BBC, like the Pentagon, but it only takes one. It could be anybody from the commissioner down to a cleaner, but the effect on the suspect is the same.
You talk about the commissioner. It seems to me you've lost faith in key institutions in this country. The Crown Prosecution Service, which is responsible for deciding whether to push a case against you and charges, and indeed the Metropolitan Police. You've said that even at the moment that they had to admit that they didn't have the evidence to bring a case against you, charges against you, you said that they couldn't resist, even as they sort of announced that there was insufficient evidence, they couldn't resist a final smear by releasing the fact that they'd been operating on the accusation that you had allegedly committed offences with males aged between 14 and 15. Seems to me that your use of this word smear makes it seem as though you think it was a personal animus that, for example, the chief of the Metropolitan Police had against you.
Yes. And also an attempt by the CPS to justify its own mendacious behavior. You have to remember, the police handed the case to the CPS after 3.5 months. It was the CPS that then sat on me for 8 months, although they object to the use of the word sat. So let's say knelt. They knelt on me for 8 months. And I would invite the CPS to release my full file. Since I never knew my two accusers, it must be so thin it would make Weight Watchers jealous. The only thing that could be in there is lurid fan fiction about me, like 50 Shades of Grey. And it was amazing that the CPS kept rebailing me. And don't think that the police and CPS walk in lockstep. A lot of police officers resent the CPS because they consider rebails the return of their homework, saying not good enough, must try harder. And they think that it is an exercise of power by the CPS over the police to remind them of who's really in charge.
If I may, I want to bring it back to your accusers. In recent days, you've suggested that people making false accusations should face criminal sanction or, at the very least, have to undertake sort of medical supervision, be given some sort of medical supervision. And yet you've also said to me that you've made a point of never attacking your own accuser. So do you feel that the man who accused you first should now face punishment?
I think, first of all, my sense is that he requires medical treatment because I was told. Should it be mandatory?
Because that's what you appeared to be suggesting.
No, it should be mandatory that they either be prosecuted or have medical attention. But you see, my accuser supposedly had been expelled from boarding school for making a false sexual allegation.
But without going into too much detail about him, what message would that send to others who are still out there, who have been abused but are very worried about the trauma of going to the police, going through the whole investigatory process? You're now saying that if any accusations don't stand up in court, if convictions aren't delivered, that they then need to be sanctioned or at least face the possibility of having to have a sort of medical supervision. That's going to put so many people off.
It's very easy to detect warning signs if you are going to be impartial. When there is a false accusation, usually the details around it are false as well. And even if the police are interested in the sexual aspect of the allegation, the other parts of the story won't hold up. For example, I mean, my case is set in the decade before I started having sexual relations with men. I mean, they were off by a decade. I gave them the name of the man who was my first. And you know what? They never got in touch with him, even though he was an RAF veteran and he could be tracked down within 10 seconds. Now, I would have to say that, of course, I sympathize very much with those who have genuinely been abused. And I've said that, and I've spoken out on their behalf. But we're all in this together. And you can tell a bad one, even in the aftermath, because I'm talking about in the aftermath of the case.
I just want to end on a thought about forgiveness and about coming to terms with your own hurt and anger, both thinking about your accuser, but also thinking about this country, your adopted home. You've said that after everything that's happened, you feel betrayed, psychologically tortured, and abandoned by the country I'd come to love.
No one loves a country as much as someone who has chosen to live there. I was not born in Britain. I was an American. I chose to live here. I recommended to my fellow Americans that they moved here if they could, because it was a more humane place in which to live. The British people were a great and generous people. They gave me a quality education and health service, and I enjoyed a career the likes of which could not be imagined until I lived it. So imagine how I felt when I was betrayed by the institutions of that country. There's so much that will be coming out in the next couple of years from other falsely accused. And I think people will see the patterns and will realize that the police really were fishing. This was an operation of so-called reputational importance. And God bless whoever gets in the way of a police operation of operational importance.
And your accuser, do you forgive him?
Yes, because I don't know him. It's easy to forgive him, because I am convinced that he is a distressed individual.
BBC broadcaster Paul Gambaccini speaking with Stephen Sacker about the false accusations that were made against him through Operation Yew Tree. We will have more on Tony Blackburn, which I mentioned at the beginning of the program, as soon as we get more in. You are listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Now time to turn our attention to propagation, what's been happening, and what we can expect. Here's Glenn Hauser.
Keith from IPS in Australia, the global HF propagation forecast through March 5th. Normal at low and middle latitudes. Normal to fair at high latitudes. From Space Weather South Africa through March 5th, magnetic conditions quiet to unsettled. Shortwave fade-outs unlikely, MUF unstable. From Met Office UK, the space weather forecast through March 6th. Solar activity very low, just a slight 5% chance of moderate class flares. Geomagnetic activity with the greatest chance of minor G1 storms, planetary K index of 5 on March 5th. From Natural Resources Canada, the long-term magnetic activity forecast calls for the most unsettled conditions March 15th, peaking at 110 nanoteslas in the auroral zone. From FK Yanda in Prague, the geomagnetic field will be quiet to active March 3rd to 5th, 7th, 10th, 14th, and 17th. Active to disturbed March 6th, 15th, and 16th. Quiet to unsettled March 8th, 9th, and 22nd. Quiet on March 11th, 12th, 18th, and 20th. Mostly quiet March 13th, 19th, 21st, and 23rd. From SWPC in Boulder, geomagnetic field is expected to be at active levels March 6th, with A and K indices of 15 and 4, reaching G1 minor storm levels March 14th to 16th, with A and Ks peaking at 30 and 5. Then a quiet period of 5 and 2 from March 19th to 26th. Solar flux peaking March 4th at 115, declining steadily to 95 by March 16th. RSGB points out we are now entering a period where north-south paths are potentially much better on HF, but east-west paths may suffer, especially on the higher bands. William Hepburn's VHF UHF DX maps show extreme tropospheric ducting all week off the central Pacific coast of Mexico and the northwest coast of Australia, around the coasts of South Africa, March 4th and 5th, from India to Oman until March 4th, from Oman to Somalia until March 7th.
Thanks a lot, Glenn. And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. If you'd like to get in touch with us, our email address is, as always, PCJ. No, it isn't. That's the end of the address. It actually is MNP at PCJmedia.com. Yes, a bit of a long week. That's all I can say. Anyway, on behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. 73 and 88 to the ladies. Thank you.